Hey everybody, before we get going on this week's episode, just a quick reminder, we have a free live episode of the podcast coming up this week, Thursday the 24th at Iowa West in the Loft, which is their cozy little space upstairs. It's 10:30 p.m. Again, it is free. Our guests are going to be James Urbaniak, Andy Merrill, who's coming back very quickly after coming on for his first time, Jeremy Guskin, friend of the show, and Taylor Jessen, Firesign's archivist, who you've heard on the show before as well. We're going to be discussing Monty Python's Another Monty Python Record. It'll be fun. It'll be a quick hour. It'll be, again, it is free. Come to the show. Say hello to everybody. And you might even win something, and it's probably going to be a defaced Bill Cosby album. So enjoy that, and enjoy this episode. I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1972, the album is Class Clown, and the artist is George Carlin. My guest this week is Lee Camp, calling me from New York. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing all right. How are you?
I am good. So, why Class Clown? I mean, I know why I would pick it, because it's one of the first albums we did, because it is one of my favorite of all time. But why is it important to you?
Well, I think it represents Carlin's shift. I mean, that along with AM/FM and maybe some other work, but it represents his shift from a kind of standard, still very funny, but a standard, more Ed Sullivan show kind of comedian into a counterculture icon. And, you know, there's plenty of observational material in there, so it's not like it's all counterculture and all... political at all.
Sure.
It has those feelings and sentiments of you know, being outside the norm and believing in things that don't fit into the normal hierarchy, and you know, screw you if you can't handle it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the image, even the image of a funny hippie, was even, it was perfectly comfortable for people to eventually accept. But when he starts talking out, and when he starts like having opinions, that becomes troublesome for some people, even though that's not as present here. But there's still, you know, you can hear it definitely in talking about the war, and just, you know, simply spending an entire track talking about swear words.
It's talking about swear words, yeah. Saying why do we act like you can't say these things? And even just the image on the front, you know, the long hair and the beard was enough to scare a lot of people.
For sure, for sure. And even I feel like even the people who are comfortable with that image of him might have been a little bit shocked. One hopes. I mean, that does seem to have been the effect on a lot of people.
Yeah, this was the guy who came from the hippy-dippy weatherman on Ed Sullivan, and he was scaring a lot of people. He was scaring some people that used to be his fans, but obviously he decided that was okay, and in a way that was a little bit inspirational for me. You know, I was a clean comedian for many years and was touring a lot of colleges and then became interested in politics for reasons unrelated to George Carlin, but it kind of showed, you know, you can do that with comedy. You can take on tough ideas and make them funny, and make them funny to a crowd that isn't necessarily ready for them.
Yeah, absolutely. When is the first time you ever heard this album? Because I mean, it came out 8 years before either of us were born. So I'm curious when you first heard it.
Yeah, I heard it when it first came out, before I was born. It was very early. I don't actually know, but I came pretty late to a lot of the greats like Carlin and Hicks and many others, because I grew up in a fairly standard suburban family. So, and we weren't, it's not like my parents were like never curse, you know, and it said never curse in the household, but it was pretty shocking to see a comedian do that. So I remember seeing some Carlin on HBO and I was probably, you know, 14 or something. Mm-hmm. And I know there's plenty of 14-year-olds. If you have a brother running around saying fuck all day, then you're kind of used to it. But
yeah,
for me, when I first saw Carlin on HBO, I was like kind of shocked, you know, and kind of like, oh, that's not really good comedy because he's got to use all those curse words.
Sure. But
I, of course, very much have changed that view.
Yeah, it's a very comforting embrace once you finally realize that all it is a new freedom.
Yeah, a new freedom. And honestly, is my, I mean, I was cursing in my regular life when I was, once I became an adult. Uh-huh. And my comedy was clean for a long time. But once I started talking about politics on stage, my stuff got understandably angrier. And as it got angrier, it really stopped making sense that I wasn't cussing on stage, you know, or really saying any words that seemed impolite. And I think it seemed fake to the audience, which it was fake. It was not the way I would talk when I get angry in my regular life. So
sure.
Why am I going on stage and saying, oh, gosh darn.
Yeah, I mean, that's an even bigger put on than people swearing just for the sake of it, I feel like. That's it must have been really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So what were you listening to then? What were your influences, let's say, before Carlin, that were influencing your let's not swear, let's not, you know, let's find a different way to express ourselves on stage?
Well, Seinfeld was the big one. Mm-hmm. I think like a lot of comedians my age, I definitely he was the model of what a comedian was to me and what I wanted to be, and he was also inspirational in making me think I could do it because I read his book, which was his stand-up material, and mm-hmm. and thought, you know, I have these same funny thoughts, and I was already writing some comedy stuff, so. Another inspiration, although he's not a performer, was Dave Barry, a very clean humor columnist,
sure.
You know, suitable for being published in conservative newspapers, and any newspaper across the country wasn't afraid he was going to say something that was going to touch a nerve.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
So yeah, it was that. Maybe a little bit of Kaffigan and stuff, but definitely a lot of Seinfeld.
Do you know how? Approximately how old you were? I mean, you're already into being, I mean, I know you started pretty young as far as writing comedy, but performing, when did you start?
I started performing close to 18. I was still 17.
Mm-hmm.
But I started writing at like 12, but I started writing stand-up bits at about 13, 14, mm-hmm. and that's also how old I was when Seinfeld's book came out. So I was already writing some humor, but I wasn't trying to write stand-up until 13, 14.
That's perfect timing. That is kind of this butter zone that I've noticed with a lot of people, including myself. Like 13, 14 is about the time when you're discovering that you actually have the ability to, in our case, like literally put pen to paper, but, you know, put pen to paper in whatever sense. Like you can actually make shit that's your own, you know?
Yeah, and you kind of need someone to tell you that this is a thing that can be done.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you kind of, if I didn't read the intro to Seinfeld's book, and if I didn't, there were a few other, you know, pivotal moments in my young life where I understood that other people are, you know, other regular people do this, like start writing comedy and start performing it and stuff like that, then otherwise you just think it's some freak thing that person's doing on a stage that you could never do.
Right. That it just sort of happened. It's very nebulous unless, yeah, I mean, having that advice in front of you has got to be invaluable. That's pretty great. I mean, I don't recall having any books like that when I was that age, so it did sort of feel like, well, maybe this will coalesce into something eventually. And yeah, having a book like that, I feel like would help a lot of young people, you know, if they've got like that, or even Steve Martin's book or anything.
Yeah, absolutely. And then so it's interesting the steps that it took, you know. So I spent many years trying to do like Seinfeld did, be a clean observational comic, and then mm-hmm. it was Carlin and Hicks and Chris Rock and some others who made me start going outside of that and start thinking that, well, for me, the Seinfeld route is wrong. I don't want to never curse. I don't want to only talk about cotton balls. And I care about the greater issues in the world, and that's what I want to talk about and get angry about and be loud about. And so it kind of took those guys to be like, you know, there's other comedy routes other than just the Seinfeld route.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even though it's interesting because I speak to a lot of people who I think maybe misunderstand certain types of comedy, for instance, yours or Carlin's or any of the people you just named, where they think their opinion is, well, you know, goal number one is to be funny. Well, of course it is. Every comic understands that. But I think people think if you're angry on stage or if you actually have a point to make or if there's a genuine theme beyond just isn't this interesting, that you're trying too hard or that you're losing the point of comedy. Was there like an obvious turning point for you where like, well, no, fuck that. It's okay for me to actually have a point and have like maybe even an activist angle to what I do, to have a purpose to it. Some people think that's a little too hoity-toity.
I was never really scared of that. What I remember being scared of is I remember having a time early in my comedy where I thought if anybody was offended by anything, if I heard even 1 out of 100 people go, oh, then I had done something wrong.
Okay, yeah.
That meant I'd, you know, that one person meant that I'd gotten it wrong and I had offended them in some way. And then I realized that not only is that okay, but you should be going for that. You shouldn't want 100 people to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're making every single person in that room has not a single boundary pushed, not a single moment are they like, oh, I don't know about that. Then you're probably not going to the edge. You're probably not doing anything that special.
Sure.
You know, it definitely I reversed on that. I don't remember having a strong opinion of like, that you can't, ironically, have opinions on stage.
Right.
I think that all of it seemed like opinions to me, but I do know that some people say, and there's plenty of comedians that say, like, oh, yeah, if you're trying to give a political message on stage, then you aren't doing your job.
Right.
No, I'm absolutely doing my job. I'm just doing my job differently than you are, so go fuck yourself.
100%, 100%. I mean, that was kind of a revelation for me, like, in college when I for some reason thought it was a good idea to minor in philosophy. At the very least, the one thing that really actually helped me was sort of realizing that other angle to Carlin and realizing, oh shit, like, I mean, I knew what it meant to me to listen to this album, but then to know what it meant on a larger level, just to be as pretentious as possible about it, I was like, holy shit, he was affecting change, you know, whether it was immediate or not. Like the idea that you can, that this really seemingly goofy art form could have this kind of impact. It's interesting that it took a stupid philosophy class to teach me that. But did you ever have that kind of revelation about comedy, or did you always sort of understand that maybe that was an underlying possibility?
I think it was kind of a revelation in that once I started realizing I wanted to make a difference in the world, and I don't mean in comedy, I just mean in general.
Sure.
I became more political and more of an activist and wanted to tell people about the truth of our reality. Once I realized I wanted to do that, then it's kind of inevitable that you're going to want to put that on the stage. Because, you know, I kind of figured if I've been given the gift to have an audience on such a regular basis, it started to seem to me like a waste to not use that for something important, something good. You know, it just felt like kind of a waste to get on stage and not say anything of importance. Now, at the same time, that doesn't mean I don't love certain comedians that that have no message, you know,
sure.
Have no message, you know, like absurdist comedians like Stephen Wright. But it just wasn't for me. I was an activist off stage, and I wanted to take that on stage and yet still find a way to not make half the crowd walk out. I mean, I did comedy in the trenches in New York City for 12 years, in which most nights no one had ever heard my name before and
sure.
In the audience. So you can't alienate all of them, or the clubs are going to stop booking you. So you have to find a way to say the important, you know, have the kernels of truth in there with something that's funny enough that it's going to keep them there.
Absolutely. I'm not a stand-up myself. So, and I honestly don't know what Carlin's method was. I mean, I know that he was kind of, he loved to take notes. He was like a big note taker. And what is your, what's your basic process?
Well, I do know, and actually I've gotten lucky enough to become friends with Kelly Carlin, his daughter.
She's wonderful.
And yeah, she's awesome. And so I know some of his method, and I know that he would take a ton of notes, but he would also write everything pretty much word for word.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe rewrite things later. But his stuff was very word for word, which is different than like a Hicks where it would vary probably almost every night.
Mm-hmm.
Mine is probably somewhere in between those two, although closer to the Carlin side of things. I think my best stuff is pretty well written, and then it gets honed the more it's performed on stage. Usually a lot of the fat gets cut out. I'm definitely more of the, I come from more of the writing world than the class clown world. Whenever I see a comedian say like, oh yeah, I don't write anything, I just have a topic and I walk out there. And there's so few comedians mm-hmm. where that ends up being really good comedy.
Right,
So few that they just have a topic and they just go out and talk and it's amazing.
Right,
and
right.
Usually if they tell you that, they're either lying or they're not as good as they think they are.
Right.
So I definitely come from the writing world, but also now with the TV show Redacted Tonight, I write so far in the series, I write every word I say, and it's basically writing a new show every week. So in that case, there's no honing. You write the show and you do it and you perform it, and we have a live audience, and that's it. And then you dump it and you write a new show for the next week. So
yeah,
it is definitely kind of a constant process of just keep writing and creating. But I don't think I could do that, meaning write a show without honing it in front of an audience at all, if I hadn't had, you know, 15 years in front of stand-up clubs.
Of course, yeah. All right, so I obviously the most memorable track off this album is going to be Seven Words You Can't Say on Television, but is that the one for you, or is there another one that hit you harder or that you remember stronger? I mean, I can go down the list if you want, because I've got it right in front of me.
I think that probably is the one that, you know, that's also the one where he puts the hilarious warning on the front of the cover about, but that, you know, that, and I know you know, but you maybe your listeners don't know that track then went all the way to the Supreme Court as to whether mm-hmm. NPR had the right to air that. And it really speaks to the fact that, you know, George Carlin and Lenny Bruce and a handful of others fought for our right to be able to say on stage and sometimes on radio and television what we want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it really did kill Lenny Bruce in that he was chased around every club he played and ultimately couldn't get booked at most of the clubs because they were afraid they'd have their liquor license taken away
right.
and everything else. And, you know, ultimately the stress of that and the lawsuits and possibly going to jail caused a meltdown that killed him.
Yeah. It is what's great. The whole track, I mean, it's a 7-minute track. It is not the longest track on it, although it is the longest segment about any one thing on the entire thing. The longest one is the actual class clown bit, which is 16 minutes, but it's made up of three different pieces. But Seven Words is appropriately enough 7 minutes long. And he spends more time on some words than he does on others. I mean, he does a total of 10 or so actual words. And then he, you know, the partial words, the half words. It's so silly. Like, that's the thing. The entire bit is played off as so silly and sweet. And it is actually very sweet in some parts. But it's interesting to me that would just, it's just the words that nobody, and this is not uncommon, nobody was hearing what he was actually saying beyond the fact that there were a couple of words that just stood out to them.
Right, and I've got an interesting follow-up in my own career. The only time I'm pretty good about, like, when I'm on TV, I know not to say mm-hmm. certain words, but the only time I've ever had a host hit the like panic button that cuts away 5 seconds of a radio broadcast because you just said something that isn't allowed on the airwaves.
I know.
was because I was in, I don't even remember where, Iowa or somewhere, and I'm on this little radio station. This, you know, nice little lady is talking to me, and she says, "Oh, well, do one of your jokes for us. Do one of your jokes." And so I'm trying to think, okay, what joke can I do that isn't, doesn't have any bad words in it? So I start doing the bit, and I get to a point where I realize the next phrase that I normally say, because I'm talking about children, is, you know, these teachers have to take care of these little shitheads. And I knew not to say shitheads, but so I just thought, well, what do I replace that with to make it clean? So I go, oh, the teachers have to take care of these little pricks.
And, shoot.
And that was not good enough. She flipped out and hit the red panic button. It was like, you can't say that. And if only I'd remembered Carlin's line about you can say you pricked your finger, but not your finger to prick.
That is the perfect ending to that entire bit. It's just, it's so, like, metaphorically, it's absolutely perfect. Like, just saying that, you know, you can talk about violence, but you can't talk about sex. It's all condensed into that one little sentence at the tail end. It's one of the perfect buttons of all comedy. But what's funny too, though, is like the guys who are any law enforcement who is following him and trying to fuck him over, they were hearing the exact, they were as pissed off by that for the same reasons as I was excited by it when I was 16, hearing it for the first time. Like, holy shit, he's swearing. Eventually, my brain set in. I'm like, oh, I get what he's doing. But it's crazy that these adults could never get past the simple words. It's just, it's not that upsetting to me because, again, like you say, he made a lot of progress for us by, you know, sticking through it as long as he did. Let's go through maybe the track listing. So if we go to side one, the first track is Class Clown, and the three bits are Bilabial Fricative, Attracting Attention, and Squeamish. Bilabial Fricative is the one that sticks out to me, just because it's a great phrase.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything about that particular track that stands out, but we got Class Clown, then we've got Wasted Time, Sharing a Swallow, and then Values. How much is that dog crap in the window? Which, again, it's very cutesy for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that a lot of people don't remember is he got a lot darker there at the end, and he got a little darker even in the 90s and his, you know, stuff about war and
sure,
we love to bomb brown people and stuff like that. But
mm-hmm,
his stuff, even though it was still cutting under the standard beliefs, the standard paradigms that we live in, it was a lot cutesier back then, and there was a lot of silliness in it. And you know, perhaps he had to go through the kind of sillier period in order to make that transition from the hippy-dippy weatherman to where he ultimately got to.
On October 21st, 2015, Stolen Dress Entertainment, in conjunction with Team Fox, brings you the Million McFly March. Fans of the Back to the Future franchise will gather, dressed as Marty McFly, to participate in the largest gathering of Marty McFlys in history and celebrate the Back to the Future films while also raising money for Parkinson's research through Team Fox. More details about the event, as well as links to donate and RSVP for the event, can be found at millionmcflymarch.com.
Now, we can talk about that transition too, because I feel like, obviously, if this is the first thing you're hearing, you still want to keep listening. But I've seen enough of your comedy to know which Carlin you lean more towards. Was it immediately affecting you when you heard this, or did it have to, like, eventually it evolved into, oh no, we're getting to the darker Carlin, and this is the stuff that actually really is kind of feeding me?
Well, yeah, I think the darker Carlin is what grabbed me. So I listened to that the most first, and then I kind of went back and listened to a lot more of his stuff. But yeah, it was definitely the more political, darker stuff that really kind of blew my mind and showed me that you can take something that's so harsh and so dire if you really look at it on its face value. And if you mock it in a successful way, if your satire is working correctly, then you can have a whole crowd not just laughing about it, but thinking about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would really only attribute that kind of transformation in my mind of maybe, you know, two or three things. It's like Carlin and, you know, Catch-22, the book was another one. Reading Heller's lines, you know, these just sick stuff that's going on about war, yet you're kind of cracking up at how ridiculous he's made it.
Yeah.
And here we are. It seems like war has gotten so insane that it's almost tough to mock some of the time.
Yeah. Were you, now did he obviously influenced your style and what you felt it was okay to speak about and the way you felt you could express yourself on stage, but did he influence you in terms of, oh shit, that's an idea I haven't thought about, and therefore you've got this new kind of, you know, seed in your brain, or like, you know, you're expanding on it yourself and you've got this new perspective on the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, rather than thinking like, oh, that's a great idea for me to work on with my stand-up, because I never wanted to step on anyone's toes or seem like I was doing anything derivative. But so generally when he had the best points, I think my normal response was, fuck, why didn't I think of that?
Right. So after this, do you remember what you went to next? Were you buying Carlin albums, or were you finally deciding you wanted to actually watch those specials that you were turning away from originally?
I mean, I watched several of them and bought some DVDs and then collected a few vinyls. This is the one, though. This is the album that I got Kelly to sign. It was after George's death, so
sure.
there was no hope in getting that signature. But
yeah.
It's pretty cool to have it on my wall with Kelly Carlin's signature, and it's next to I have a Dick Gregory vinyl I got to open for him, and he signed that one, and that's another guy who broke down a lot of barriers in comedy.
That's amazing. You got him to sign a wow. Do you have, all right, let's go a little further down the Carlin rabbit hole here. Is there anything maybe more obscure that you don't think people know enough about as far as Carlin's concerned? Or is there like a specific bit on any of his albums that really stands out to you outside of this one, the Seven Words?
Well, I mean, I think if you're going to go to the sillier side of things, I think one I would always point to is A Place for Your Stuff.
Sure.
Was one that kind of showed his brilliance in breaking something down, something that seemed, and you know, that fits very much into the Seinfeld world of looking, and you know, he was doing it even before Seinfeld, obviously,
sure.
But looking at something that seems so normal and breaking it down to such a place that you're like, Jesus Christ, we really are just going from one little stack of stuff to another stack of stuff.
Yeah.
And there was such a brilliance in that. And that's why I'm kind of glad I went through being a clean comedian, an observational comedian first. Because otherwise, and I've met comedians who are talking about the same subjects that I am, and that part I like. But because they jumped into comedy immediately doing that, immediately saying, oh, I want to talk about the things that are going to push buttons and I want to talk about really tough issues, and never learning how to just break things down comedically initially.
Yeah.
I think you don't often end up with a well honed comedian, like a multifaceted comedian.
Yeah, you can become this just monstrous rant machine with very little form. And I've seen
right.
it. I mean, I'm sure you have too. It's sad because you can tell, well, shit, this person has some good ideas, but boy, oh boy, they do not know how to express them.
Right.
What about, I mean, let's talk about, is there anything maybe of the, for lack of a better word, the darker Carlin that sort of still sits with you to this day? I mean, like, you know, he was notorious for picking apart things that you were not supposed to, and however much of that was a character and however much of that was actually really, really, really him, some of them I feel like stick out more than others.
Yeah, I mean, several of the bits on war, the bit on bombing brown people, to go back to what you said earlier about did anything he say open up my worldview.
Yeah.
When I first heard that bit, I was I was pretty young and I was kind of offended.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have the understanding of what goes on in our military campaigns in our world. I didn't have enough understanding to understand really what he meant. I thought he was just kind of being offensive to be offensive.
Right.
And then you learn more about the history and what we've done, what other countries have done, some intentional, some not intentional, but it was like, oh my God, he's speaking the truth. He wasn't just saying it to be offensive. It was a great point in there. And so that was pretty crazy. I know that the line where I always, one of those lines where I always think, why didn't I think of that is, the line about abortion where he says, you know, if you're pre-born, you're fine. If you're preschool, you're fucked. It's something like that.
Yep.
where it's like, I think he was specifically talking about the Republicans, but you could probably go more broad than that. But he was like, these motherfuckers, they don't, you know, but before you're born, they all kind of care all about you. But the moment you're born, fuck it.
Oh man. So we've talked about kind of who your earlier influences were. Obviously Carlin's a big hit and just like this big change for you. And you said you moved on to listening to like Bill Hicks. What are some other influences that might, well, first of all, that maybe we would expect after listening to this era of Carlin, but then maybe some stuff that we wouldn't necessarily expect that are still affecting you in terms of your comedy?
Well, it's almost too many to list. I think some people are surprised when I say Dennis Miller because he's become so right-wing nutbag.
Sure.
But he had some great years in there, and, you know, I wore out his 1984 album.
Mm-hmm.
Was it the Off-White album or something?
Yep.
I listened the hell out of that, and he just had some brilliant stuff, but he was definitely an influence. Doug Stanhope, Chris Rock, I think, doesn't get enough credit for being a political comedian, and I honestly think that's probably just because he's black, and so people go, oh, that's not a political comedian, it's a black comedian.
Right, yeah.
And he had some brilliant stuff, you know, about how they'll never cure AIDS, they'll just make it something you can live with.
Yep.
Because the money's not in the cure, the money's in the comeback.
Right.
I mean, how true is that?
I know.
To this day. So, really great stuff from him. Some that you might not, that people might not expect that were influential is Stephen Wright, Mitch Hedberg, because I do, if anyone's seen my stand-up hours opposed to the TV show, I do these little one-liners every once in a while that are very different from anything else I do, and they're designed to kind of lighten the mood and bring back people in the audience that maybe I was getting too political for. For those jokes, which I also enjoy writing, that's definitely inspired by Hedberg and Stephen Wright and reading Steve Martin's book. He gave me the kind of the balls, reading his book gave me the balls to try doing that, try stopping mid-rant and doing something that was completely unlike all my other comedy, because I read in his book about how he was, you know, he didn't really like going for the laugh. He liked playing with the audience, feeling the vibe, feeling them get nervous that there wasn't going to be a laugh. And so that was the first time where it kind of, because I had every moment on stage up until that point for me had been get a laugh, get a laugh, get a laugh, get a laugh. And so to be like, oh, you can play with those pauses. You can play with that moment where they're kind of, where the audience is kind of scared and confused. Maybe he's not going to pull this out. Maybe this is screwed.
Yeah.
And so that definitely was an inspiration to start trying that other type of comedy that's different than everything else I do.
I feel like those moments are integral to sort of reminding people of your humanity too, if they're scared of the darkness, if they're scared of the reality you're giving them.
Humanity,
you know what I mean? Like, people are like, oh fuck, is this guy just get, like, if people are not necessarily on board at first, that might be one of those things that says, oh right, he's a comedian. Like if yeah, you know what I mean? Like if it's a heavy rant that isn't necessarily as, if they don't get it, You know, I feel like they can pull him back in.
Well, I'll tell you, something that only comedy nerds can appreciate is it unintentionally served as a kind of crazy experiment in comedy, in that I would go to these, you know, the real hipster rooms, like the underground Williamsburg, Brooklyn rooms, and they largely didn't like my main stand-up, my political stuff, because it's very uncool to care that passionately about an idea.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so they would largely, I really wouldn't do that well during the rants, during the political stuff. But then I'd pull up a pad, which is a kind of ironic detachment one-liner, and they love it. They'd go nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd put the pad away, and they'd get bored again, and then I'd pull it out, and they'd get excited again.
Oh, my God.
And so it was really kind of a very polarizing thing. And then I went to, I was also booked a bunch at this isn't a derogatory term. I think people outside comedy might not know this, but one of the black rooms in New York, the Laugh Lounge was a very black and Hispanic crowd. And I was one of the only white comics that she would put on regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the complete opposite. They loved my political stuff because, you know, it's talking about something real. It's talking about something that's affecting a lot of people's lives, and a lot of it they were really into. And then I'd pull the pad out and do the one-liner, and they'd stare at me like I just shat all over the place. Like, it was so infuriating to them that I had pulled out this pad and done a joke that, it seemed like a quasi-cheesy joke.
Yeah.
It just made them, angry almost.
Yeah. That's so fat. I mean, it shouldn't be surprising, I guess, that sincerity is attractive, but it's, you know, to most audiences, again, like you say, that's a very specific audience that is that upset with your sincerity because they're not comfortable with their own emotions. But, like, it's very interesting that you would have to convince people that sincerity is a good thing, and that's part of it. I mean, that is like a cool version of apathy, and that's upsetting. And what you were doing is exactly anti-apathy, the same thing that Carlin was doing, if nothing else.
Yeah, and if you look at the comedians that have come out of that scene, and these are great comedians, and I'm friends with some of them, but, you know, Dimitri Martin and Zach Galifianakis and those guys, it very much is not about staying on stage that you passionately care about a political idea.
Sure, yeah.
Even though, you know, Zach has done plenty of charity work and political stuff. And
right.
These are great guys and funny comedians, but they had success in those rooms by not being passionate about political ideas.
For sure, absolutely. And it's hard, like, because I love their stuff, and I'm as attracted to that stuff as I am any comedian who has a voice and who can express that in a way that still makes me laugh. It's interesting that, I mean, again, not surprising that you're going to find slightly different audiences, but it does make me curious which of the audiences are being affected in more a positive way. I mean, again, because you're fighting. I think both sides, though, are fighting against apathy. I mean, getting somebody to laugh is getting them to pay attention to the here and now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess if you're like, well, you've already pulled that out of me, I'm doing that, why do you have to make me think? I suppose is a different type of person, and that's not necessarily the audience that you're shooting for. But I do wonder, though, if you have you ever had the experience where you've noticeably been able to turn an audience or turn somebody obviously to your side where it's like, oh, I get what he's doing? Or is that ever happened that you've noticed?
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes with the one-liner, people will, because those jokes are designed to be, I mean, they're kind of funny, but they're often designed to be kind of stupid in a way, like
sure.
intentionally weird or stupid. And I've definitely had crowds that when I first did the first one, they thought, like, oh, he accidentally did a bad joke.
Right, right.
And then as it went on, they were like, oh, these are intentional, and they're actually pretty funny. They're not as bad as we thought. And so, yeah, I've seen rooms change. And also, in the reverse, some have been a little turned off by my, you know, ranty quasi-political stuff, And then once I show them that I have another side, like you called it showing them my humanity, but once I've shown them that, hey, I can write these other kind of jokes too, I'm choosing not to.
Yeah.
I'm choosing not to make that the bulk of my performance. This doesn't happen that often in this way, but sometimes that has eased them into like, oh, it's okay.
Yeah.
This is a choice of his
right.
to do this political stuff. He's not a political ranty comedian that can't do anything else.
Right, exactly. And I feel like that's... I think the only reason I've got any perspective on that is that's how I was when I first heard Carlin's later stuff, because I knew this album very well as a kid, and then I heard his stuff on HBO and I'm like, I don't fucking care, this is not for me at all. It took a long time for me to turn around on him, and mm-hmm. you know, some of it's still like not necessarily the stuff that I want to listen to on repeat, although honestly right. it's Bad For You is one of the greatest final albums of anybody's career, if not the best. It's a gorgeous album, I think. It's a perfect coda to everything.
He got very dark. He definitely scared some people. But I think it also speaks to his, I mean, he did get to a point, and you know, he would say this in interviews, that he didn't care if people laughed.
Oh yeah.
And and I mean, if you're as good as him, then that's, you can do that when you get to that point. Now if you're starting and not caring whether people laugh,
yeah, right,
you're in trouble.
That's absolutely true. I mean, it feels like that's one of those things, you know, I guess maybe it's obvious. It's easier to take those chances later on. It's easier to take those chances if you're more, you know, if you're more well off, if you got less to lose. But, I want to know if it still feels like a risk to you, or if it just feels honest and you're okay if there's a bit of a risk to it.
I don't mind some risk, mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, just to launch into these topics is a pretty big risk.
For sure.
So I obviously am not that turned off by risk, but at the same time, you know, my own inadequacies or perceived inadequacies make me kind of always want to make a crowd laugh. I've never, and you know, for example, Bill Hicks was pretty well known for, if things weren't going well, he was fine with just going after the audience,
yeah,
and spending 20 minutes without a laugh.
You yeah.
know, if things weren't hitting his way, and I've never been that type. I've always tried to win over the crowd. I mean, that doesn't mean it's always happened, and I've certainly realized halfway through a set, these are not my people, and fuck this.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never really sought that out, because it's too soul destroying to watch a whole room just think you're a moron. So
yeah, I mean, and that's the interesting thing too, is like, again, obviously Carlin had this deep feeling, loving heart until the day he died. There's no doubt in my mind about it, regardless of what he said on stage. He obviously still had, it's not a black heart, it's just a wounded heart. Like, and that's one of those things you hear, and I feel like, at the very least, keeping some of that, and I'm sure he did, keeping some of that, well, fuck, if they're not laughing, I mean, you know, what am I supposed to, why am I here? Like, that's just one of those things that tears you up, but I do think it takes, for lack of a better word, it takes balls to keep doing something where you're being outspoken and trying to turn it into comedy, then getting those laughs, hopefully. Like, that's one of the... this is a riskier form of comedy. And is it less of a risk for on your show because you've got an audience who knows, they have an expectation.
Yeah, it's definitely less of a risk. I mean, with a studio audience, they're almost all aware of what I do already. And also with a TV show with a viewpoint like Redacted Tonight,
mm-hmm.
it's more of my job. You know, when I go on a stand-up stage, and especially if the crowd doesn't know me, then probably 70% of my job is to make them laugh, and 30% is to, in my view, say important things, or you know, even if it's 50-50. Whereas on my show, Redacted Tonight, I feel like saying important things is probably over 50%. It's probably 60% of my job, 70%. And then the laughs is not necessarily secondary, but it's not The laughs are definitely first on a stand-up stage.
Sure.
Whereas on a TV show that's there to make a point and there to talk about these important issues specifically, then it's those two things share a podium. So
yeah,
in that way, whereas on a stand-up stage, if I were truly bombing and I really wanted to win back the crowd, I would go back to old jokes that didn't have much of a point.
Sure, sure.
I knew I could win them back with. Whereas with a TV show, it's not an option.
So. Yeah. No, that's more without a net than I would expect. That's an interesting perspective on I wouldn't have thought about. Now, what we'd like to do towards the end of an episode is we like to tell the audience, if somehow you've never heard, let's just assume we've got a first-time listener here who's never heard Carlin, knows nothing about him, or only knows later era Carlin, what's a reason to listen to this album? How can you condense, why is this album important?
I'd say if I had to shrink it down to a few sentences, it changed comedy. A lot of people change comedy, but this was an album that broke down a lot of barriers, scared a lot of people, and had a court case that went all the way to the Supreme Court as to freedom of speech. So how many albums can you say that about?
That's absolutely true. And what's funny is, by the way, is looking at, I have the Wikipedia article in front of me just for anything I might forget. And they've always got like a royalty-free version of the cover. And it's got, obviously, his warning. But the hilarious part is this is obviously a later copy because it's got the actual parental advisory on it, which is fucking hilarious and fucking ridiculous.
That one added to what, the 80s or 90s?
Yeah, had to have been. I mean, blame Tipper Gore for that. So that's perfect. I mean, and it did. It changed comedy. It changed culture. What kind of stuff? What do you have to promote? Where can people find you online?
So yeah, I have a weekly TV show on RT America called Redacted Tonight. But you can also watch it on YouTube. So just youtube.com/redactedtonight. That's REDACTED tonight. And if you have trouble remembering that, everything I have is at leekamp.net. I'm Lee Camp on Facebook and on Twitter.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun. So, guys, go watch Redacted tonight. Go listen to.
And I've got two or three, whatever it is, comedy albums out there. So, if you guys are into comedy albums, I hope you'll check them out. They're all on iTunes, Pepper Spray, The Tears Away, Chaos for the Weary, and then one DVD video performance that's at my website called the performance is called We Are Nothing.
That's awesome. We don't talk enough about political comedy on this show. It doesn't always come up, especially if it's this older, wackier stuff. So I do like people to, branch out a bit. Not that I'm your teacher, but if I am your teacher out there, go listen to branch out. And this is a good album to swing into something a little more adventurous, a little more maybe upsetting. And upsetting can be good. It can be very positive. Again, thank you for doing this show. You're welcome back anytime. And thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.